clerk will call the docket.
Richard H. Wire against Thomas Culpepper, L. Stephen Emmert, Jeff Joseph T. Waldo, Stephen J. Clark, Council for Appellant. Jeffrey A. Huber, Scott B. Helton, Council for Appellate.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert. I'm here. I'll have an extended stay here this morning. First case that we have today is Dwyer versus Town of Culpeper, which is an eminent domain case implicating the unity of lands doctrine. Based upon my clear recollection of the writ argument, I suspect some of you would prefer that I start with the finality issue, and so I propose to do that here. Many cases that you've handed down deal with finality. They define a final order as one that adjudicates all claims and so forth and so on. We're familiar with those. When a trial court enters an order like that, then by operation of law, it's final, unless another clear set of your decisions indicates that a trial court can postpone finality by including specific language.
But here, by statute, the confirmation order is deemed final, while at the same time the statute reserves jurisdiction to continue to the second phase of the
Correct.
And that's all the additional language in this order did is reflect what the statute would have done in any event.
Correct. And it is conceivable that the trial court may have inadvertently retained jurisdiction and postponed finality, but it used that language. It doesn't matter whether the finality comes from common law or from a statute. We can certainly agree that an order that...
When you agreed with my first statement, whether I communicated it, the statute says it's final. And it says, and in addition, it doesn't have the finality that every other common law finality order has. There's continuing jurisdiction in the lower court to sort out the distribution issues. This particular reservation is only narrowed down on the very thing the statute would have otherwise permitted anyway, even post-true finality. So to me, it's an apples and oranges comparison between someone reserved jurisdiction to sit on this for another 6 months versus someone reserved jurisdiction to do what the statute already reserved jurisdiction to do.
Let me identify what we agree upon first, and that is that if the trial court had omitted the phrase retained jurisdiction, it still would have been able to adjudicate these two things.
By statute.
Exactly, and we agree upon that. But the trial court included the language, I'm not going to say magic words because that's not that belittles the doctrine, but it included the key language that you have always held is sufficient to postpone finality. This is a matter of separation of powers, that the power to enter a final order and to suspend finality doesn't come from
the statute. The reservation, though, was solely, I think the word solely is in the order, isn't
right.
it?
Exactly.
Solely on the two issues which would otherwise be within the statutory reserve power anyway.
I agree.
This is no, separation of powers debate here. This is really just what the statute means.
Oh, I think it is a separation of powers, because as I was mentioning, the power to suspend finality, to postpone finality, doesn't come from a statute. It doesn't come from a statutory grant. It's one of the inherent powers of the court, like the contempt power. And the General Assembly did not specifically exclude from the circuit court the right to suspend an order to partially, the word partially is incorrect.
Can we qualify that, though? The court could have done, I think, exactly what you're saying, which is say, I'm going to enter the confirmation order. It would otherwise be final, but you know what? I'm not sure I like this confirmation decision. I want 10 days to think about it, so I'm going to reserve jurisdiction for 10 days.
You could have done that.
Well, I don't think that's what he did.
No, I agree that he didn't say, I'm going to think about these other matters. When I say other matters,
the original matters. So if you reserve jurisdiction to rethink what you've already done, you're right. The power exists based upon the sites that you have. But that's not what he did. He reserved jurisdiction to do what the statute said had nothing to do with confirmation, but everything to do with the second phase of the plan.
Well, we do agree that if he hadn't included that, he still could have done what he did, and this would be an immediately appealable order.
Yes.
But because he used the language that you have always prescribed specifically for postponing finality, he effectively did that in this case, regardless of what the statute says. The legislature did not, if the legislature is going to take away the power of the trial court to suspend finality, it would do so expressly by using the language that I put in the reply brief, I think, that said, and an order like this must
be. What's your best answer to this logical point, not a case law point? The assertion they make that he did not suspend finality on the confirmation decision. He actually very carefully chose not to do that because he solely suspended finality on something that wasn't even final. which were the distribution debates. What's the best response to that?
The response to that is that there's no partial suspension, as far as I know, in terms of a final order. A final order is going to be final or not, depending upon what the court does with it. I've also realized that we've been making a terrible mistake all along. The judge was female, and I've been calling her him, as we all have. The point is that when she had the ability to do something with this case, she could have entered an order that said, this order is final, and the court will consider these two ancillary matters as pertuned by statute. She didn't do that. She used the phrase that you have always prescribed, the exact words. You and I may not be able to agree upon this, but in my view, this is the doctrine that you have always enforced, and the General Assembly has not specifically taken away that inherent power from trial judges.
Why isn't it taken away when the General Assembly says this order is final? A confirmation order is final, even though under common law principles, actually it's not common law, but under procedural principles, it would not be final, because it's obviously interlocutory.
I don't believe that that's any different from an order in a different context where there's no statute saying this is final. If a judge says this order is final in a tort case, for example, then that triggers the 21 days and the 30 days and the 90 days and so forth. But if the court adds language that says I'll retain jurisdiction for whatever reason, then your ruling in the Superfresh case is that that suspends finality.
Except we didn't have a statute saying that, no, it actually is final.
I don't believe that makes a difference. I don't believe there is nearly final and really most sincerely final.
Well, that's the whole problem. This statute is actually exactly that. It is making an interlocutory order under every other scenario a final order, contrary to all the precedent, but the statute says it.
All I can say is, for the reasons that I've set forth, I respectfully disagree with Your Honor. I think that it is because of that language, not final. May we turn to the assignments?
Mr. Emmert, I was going to suggest to you that you might want to get to the merits of the case. You can use your time any way you like.
I appreciate it.
Obviously, that's a very important issue.
Of course. One of the reasons I wanted to begin with it. At page 508 of the appendix, we have the designation of Richard Marchitelli's expert testimony. He was the landowner's expert on development of, the condemnor's expert on the developability of the property. That's where he set forth the grounds for his opinion. Now, by statute and by companion rule 2705, we were allowed to cross-examine him on the grounds for his opinion. Now, an opponent can reveal the grounds for such an opinion on cross-examination, even though the proponent may not have that hearsay basis, that extrinsic basis, revealed on direct examination. The town now claims that the expert didn't testify about that on cross-examination, so it's therefore out. But he couldn't testify about that by rule and by statute. He was forbidden to do so. We do have the right under that rule and under the statute, 801.401.1, to bring out the hearsay basis, the things that he considered in reaching his conclusion. The town also tries to scurry away here from this written designation of the grounds of the expert's testimony by saying that these are just matters he consulted, but he didn't actually rely upon it. The statute and the rule don't give us that luxury of saying, well, he didn't say anything directly there. The landowner, as you've said, has an absolute right to cross-examine, and we had a right by statute and by rule to bring that out. In this context, assignment one becomes even more clear. We had a right to have the jury instructed on our theory of the case because there abundantly was more than a scintilla of evidence to support the question of whether all these parcels were being developed together. We acknowledged the Glass Doctrine. We tried to produce jury instructions consistent with the Glass Doctrine, and the trial judge's original ruling in this case was quite consistent with Glass. But what this court did in the Glass ruling was outline Mr. Glass's lack of meaningful progress toward what was basically an idea, I suppose I should say, of development. There wasn't any progress meaningfully made toward it. Instead, I invite you to consider the town's arguments that basically highest and best use is irrelevant to the unity of lands doctrine, and that a substantial amount of progress toward actual development is insufficient. Under this rule, until completion, there's no unity of use. There's no unity of lands. If that were correct, the Glass opinion would have been a lot shorter, and Justice Agee, who wrote it, could have saved a lot of time and a lot of ink.
Could I ask you this?
Certainly.
The proposed instruction doesn't include the conceptual element of actual, permanent, present joint use. It certainly includes the connection and relation and the more abstract issues, but it doesn't hit the timing point. And if I were looking at this trial judge, that would be my first problem with it.
Well, the instruction that the court did give that was proposed by the town includes those things. Mm-hmm. So what we wanted to do was to complete the presentation of the Glass Doctrine that says that when you are this far along, it is possible for a jury to find, as a matter of fact, that unity existed.
But the trial judge's instruction wasn't enough to make that clear?
Correct. That's correct. Because what we wanted to do was to tell the rest of the Glass story, which is that if you have such, you've seen the instruction, I'm not going to try to paraphrase it, but that fills in the gap between what the trial judge actually instructed and what the Glass court held. In contrast to Glass, which was basically a gossamer wish of a development plan, we had by right development at this point, because we were at the site plan stage. We had spent $185,000 in engineering plans, and the town had cashed our $12,000 site review check before turning around and condemning the property and thereby scotching the project. Under these circumstances, this should have been an issue for the jury to have considered under the unity of lands doctrine after being properly instructed. May I have leave to respond in the remaining time?
Yes, indeed. 4 minutes and 18 seconds.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Scott Helsel, and I'm appearing on behalf of the town of Culpeper. There are four reasons why the court should decline the landowner's invitation to throw out the jury's award of just compensation in this case. And I will say, in response to Mr. Emmert, the point he made, the jury was tasked with deciding whether unity of use existed. But the first issue is the appeal is untimely, which deprives the court of jurisdiction and requires dismissal. The second is, even if the court had jurisdiction, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in making any of the four instructional or evidentiary rulings that the landowner challenges. The third reason is that the town's assignment of cross error, which focuses on the motion to strike, provides this court with another reason to reject the landowner's unity of use argument, which are assignments 1, 2, and 3. And on that point, I want to briefly respond to a point in the reply brief. Pages 32 through 36 of the town's brief, we clearly set out the standard of review applicable to the assignment of cross error and the argument in support of the assignment of cross error. And so I think the contention that somehow the assignment of cross error has been abandoned is erroneous. And finally and lastly, the landowner makes no attempt to show, let alone provide any clear proof, that he was harmed by any of the rulings he challenges. And I think the amount of the award, $762,242, which is significantly above the town's main appraisal evidence in the case, and importantly also above the town's initial estimate, which was based on an appraisal that valued all eight parcels together, shows that the jury, in fact, ruled in favor of the landowner on the unity of use issue that is the central point.
There's no doubt your math works out that way, but it's awful ambiguous how much that number would have gone up or down based upon the alleged errors that the appellant's pointing out.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, because the only way, think about it, Mr. Robinson's appraisal and estimate, he estimated the three take parcels entirety, their fair market value, at about $400,000. Mm-hmm. The amount for the take itself, partially from three of those parcels, was $500,240. So the jury awarded more than Mr. Robinson said the entire 20-odd acres.
Yeah, I get you on that. There, mathematically, there has to be a unity of interest, unity of use type of component to this number. But the question is how much?
Well, I think, and then keep in mind also the gentry appraisal, which the town or the jury heard about pursuant to this court's Ramsey decision. Mr. Gentry appraised all eight parcels together, and he estimated just compensation at $466,000, and I forget the last three digits of that. But the jury's award was higher than that. So if the jury rejected Mr. Robinson's appraisal, which I think is clearly the case, the only two other appraisals, the Cantrell appraisal and the Gentry appraisal, both valued all eight properties together. So to get to $762,240, I think necessarily the jury had to award or had to be valuing all eight parcels together and thus find in favor of the landowner on the unity of use issue. I think, The town asked the trial court to submit a special interrogatory to the jury to state whether it found unity of use or not. Mm-hmm. And the town, the landowner objected, but now basically wants the court to just assume that somehow the jury didn't find in its favor on unity of use.
Well, that's a good reason for objecting to the interrogatory.
Well, I don't think it's, it's almost like approbating and reprobating. You want to say, I don't want to know, and now you really don't want to know, because if the jury did, in fact, find in his favor.
Just called litigation.
Well,
clever trial tactics.
It may be, but I do think it's inconsistent tactics.
Can you conceptually distinguish, you do it on brief, but your colleague on the other side challenges it, these ideas of highest and best use and unity of use, aren't they in fact interwoven together? Is it really clearly separated conceptually the way that you present it?
But they are not interwoven, because with unity of use, and in fact Mr. Emmert said, you know, he wasn't allowed to show that they had made substantial progress towards development. I take issue with that. In fact, if you read the landowner's closing argument, he actually pointed out to the jury the substantial progress or what they would call substantial progress. But highest and best use doesn't turn on substantial progress towards development. The landowner doesn't have to do anything for the highest and best use of property to be something other than its existing use. It could be farming, and the landowner could have no intentions, farmland, and the landowner could have no intention whatsoever of doing anything but farmland. But in the market may say, this is a better use for a shopping center. So you don't have to make any substantial progress. They're two entirely different issues. And if this court in Glass were to have focused on highest and best use rather than actual permanent and present joint use, I submit the court should have ruled in favor of Mr. Glass in that case, because all of Mr. Glass's experts testified that, in their opinion, the highest and best use of that 125-acre group of parcels was for commercial development. This court didn't say, I disagree with your highest and best use conclusion. What the court in Glass said was that you can't show an actual permanent and present joint use for something, for commercial development, when you really haven't done much to begin that development. So highest and best use and unity use are two separate issues, and to conflate them, the risk of conflating them would allow the jury, and I think this is a problem with their proposed instruction, to find unity of use without finding any actual permanent and present joint use. Justice Kelsey, you pointed out that the proposed instruction doesn't make clear that an actual permanent and present joint use is required. And I agree with you, it doesn't. And I frankly think if a non-lawyer would read it, they'd never pick up the point. Okay. However, we know that if that language is properly constructed, it does require an actual permanent and present joint use. That comes from Glass at page 150. So
the point there is using the actual permanent present joint use concept in an instruction, not using it in an instruction that's fleshing out highest and best use, is just confusing.
It is confusing because the jury could have not understood the point.
Well, we have difficulty as lawyers and judges understanding.
Correct. But even viewed in its best light, that the jury would have understood the point. The instruction the trial court gave just said the same thing, but said it more clearly. That's clearly not an abuse of discretion, and I do think the standard of review here is abuse of discretion. And I think it's notable that the landowner assigns error to the refusal of his instruction, but does not assign as erroneous the instruction the trial court gave. Now, Mr. Emmert, in his argument this morning, seemed to suggest that what the landowner really wanted was to give not only the instruction that was given, but in addition, the instruction proffered by the landowner. I submit the record doesn't support that view. The landowner wanted his instruction to be given, period. It wasn't a added to.
Do you recall where in the JA we would find the discussion that would indicate he wanted to substitute as opposed to
Yes. Yes, Justice Powell. The argument on the instruction issue begins at page 337. And I believe continues until 353. There really wasn't a whole lot of objection in that discussion to the instruction that was given. in terms of pretending it was legally erroneous. But what they really wanted was to give his instruction only. And the reason I submit he wanted to do that is because it doesn't make clear the actual permanent and present joint use test.
May I ask a question as to your expert, Mr. Marchitelli? As I read his expert designation, he did indicate that he relied on the 2010 listing.
I don't think he did, Justice Powell. He mentioned it and he said he didn't talk about it. But I think it's important, first off, to remember that Mr. Marchitelli was a rebuttal witness. He wasn't a witness that we called in our case in chief. So the only purpose of calling him at all was to rebut evidence that Mr. Dwyer may have put on. When it came time to designate rebuttal witnesses, we didn't know if Mr. Dwyer would try to introduce evidence of the listing in some form or fashion in his own case. In fact, he never did so. So there was nothing to rebut about the listing because it never came into evidence. Mr. Marchitelli, in his entire direct examination is in the joint appendix. He offered, his opinion was that Mr. Cantrell's highest and best use conclusion was unsupported because he did not believe there was sufficient market demand in the town of Culpeper to build a 256-unit or a 344-unit apartment complex on the 8 parcels. He based that conclusion and the facts that he relied upon. He did, in fact, testify. There were three. First, there were no land sales for apartment uses in Culpeper in at least 10 years, since at least 2005. Second, while the town had approved, I believe it was 320 units of multifamily construction, only 22 of those units, well, in the time period of 2002 to 2007, with no approvals after the recession, of those approved units, only 22 had been constructed, and those 22 were part of a project that failed. Okay, and the third piece of evidence that he relied upon to support his opinion was simply the number of existing apartments in the town of Culpeper. It was about 1,500, which he then compared to the amount that the landowner's evidence was proposing to construct, and he just thought there's not enough. I mean, that would be such a significant add to the inventory that you would need demand for it, and he thought there was none. He never relied upon the listing, and that's important because the statute of 801-401.1 admittedly allows cross-examination of opinions or facts the expert relies upon, but it doesn't, you need to show a foundation that the expert relied upon it.
So if your position is that if it's in his designation but he doesn't mention it in cross or in direct or cross, that they're not entitled to ask about it?
Well, there's lots of things in Mr. Marchitelli's designation that we never asked him about at trial or that he never opined about at trial. For example, there's talk about the Harrisonburg market in his designation. That was not an issue. It never became an issue that we needed to address, and therefore, we didn't ask about it. That, he didn't rely upon the Harrisonburg market that's disclosed in his designation to support his opinions about the town of Culpeper market demand issue. So I think just because something's mentioned in a designation, and it's mentioned very vaguely, doesn't automatically determine its admissibility.
Yeah, I also think this your cross error asserts that the unity of use motion instruction had been granted, right?
Yes, sir.
But there was no cross appeal filed, no separate notice of appeal.
That is correct. We did it by way of assignment of cross error.
So if the case is dismissed on the finality issue, the cross appeal would not fall, but the cross error would fall because the cross error is dependent upon the jurisdictional predicate of the original notice of appeal.
I'm not sure I understand your question, but I'll try to answer and hopefully do so correctly. I think if the court doesn't have jurisdiction over the appeal, it requires the appeal to be dismissed, and with that, the assignment of cross error would be dismissed.
Okay, so you realize that would not go back down for retrial.
And to be very clear, and I said this expressly in the brief, and I hope the point was made clearly, we're not asking for a retrial. We're okay with living with the verdict. We think we could have done better, but we're not trying to retry this case. We are interested in finality. We believe the assignment of cross error probably isn't even necessary to assign it per se as cross error. It really provides an affirmative or an alternative reason to reject the landowner's unity of use arguments because that issue should never have gone to the jury. And I do think the vested rights argument I make does make sense because until the landowner has approval, site plan approval, which undisputedly he never had here, He really has no ability to have a property right in some joint development that he clearly has never achieved.
But our case law has never gone quite that far.
It hasn't gone quite that far, but in this particular context, but I don't think it has had the need to go quite that far.
It may be perfectly logical. I'm just saying there's no precedent that does that.
There's no precedent in Virginia. I do think the dissent, the California case that the court in Glass cites as cogent, does make that point. And so I don't think it's without precedent, but I agree that no Virginia court. I want to address one other question about Mr. Marchitelli, or point about Mr. Marchitelli. In the landowner's brief, he says the principal purpose of that evidence, the listing, would have been to show unity of use. Well, 525 bars that argument because he never asked for that. What they wanted to do, and in fact, is show it as evidence of market demand, the listing. But the listing, if it's evidence of anything, is evidence of someone's opinion, either Mr. Dwyer's or the listing agent. And the landowner agrees using the listing to show someone else's opinion is hearsay and inadmissible. The landowner also agreed the listing price would not be admissible. So the way it was used, I really think, is not very, it doesn't help him. I want to end with one point. Mr. Emmert talked about finality, and he said the trial court may have inadvertently postponed finality. I don't believe a trial court can ever inadvertently postpone finality. The trial court didn't do here, so here, and I'd ask the court to dismiss the appeal or otherwise affirm it.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
I'll begin with Mr. Helsel's suggestion that the error, if any, was harmless because we got an award of over $700,000. If I got everything that we wanted below, I wouldn't be standing here because we wouldn't be aggrieved. Our experts testified to damages in excess of $3 million. And the error that the trial court made in not instructing the jury on this point cannot be said to be harmless in that regard. He also argued that the landowner was able to argue substantial progress, that we did so in the closing argument. We showed how much we had done toward actual development of the property. But the court refused to instruct the jury on the meaning of that progress. Instead, it called for the, based upon the instruction that the court did give, that there be, as the word was, actual, permanent, present, joint use without any consideration of highest and best use or that substantial progress. The jury simply was not told our theory of the case. Under those circumstances,
respond to his argument about the jury instructions, that your argument being that you wanted the instruction that was given and the one that was refused. And then
drew
us to pages 337 through 352. Is there some part of that subset of the joint appendix that you want us to focus on, or something else in the joint appendix?
Okay. The answer is I didn't have time to go through that many pages. Just now I tried to do so while he was up here, but I didn't have a chance to do that. What I do recall is we asked the jury to do this. What the jury got instead, we asked the judge to do this. What the jury got instead was what they consider the good part of Glass, and they didn't give this one. It doesn't matter, actually, whether they were requested as a supplement or as an alternative. The court gave the instruction that gave...
Well, doesn't it matter if a trial judge is told, look, you need to set this one aside, just push that off, use mine, not his. That's a very different equation than, oh, I'm okay with that, it's not all I want, and here's some supplement. That's a very different judgment call, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so in this context, because we're not objecting to their obstruction. And he's made that argument forcefully in his brief, and I'm not about to fuss with it. We're not objecting to his instruction. It's just incomplete without the one that we proposed.
But remind us of the record voluminous. You know it better than at least I do. What happened in trial? Which of those two scenarios was presented to the trial judge? Because that's what we're judging, is that decision.
I think both sides offered a separate instruction. And we're not objecting to their instruction, but we ask that our instruction be given because it's our theory of the case.
But was that made clear to the trial court? I'm not asking you to not give theirs.
Right.
I'm asking you to give mine in addition. I don't really recall that being the record, but I don't recall all of the pages of the record.
Right, and standing here, I can't say. If you like, I can find that out and give the court
a
letter
I'll
with
find
me.
It. I'll find
by Monday, if you like that.
No, I'll find it.
Okay, all right. Thank you, and I appreciate that. On Marchitelli's testimony, the first thing that Mr. Helsel says is that he was simply testifying that there was no demand. If you've read Mr. Marchitelli's designation, it obviously goes well beyond that. It talks about impracticality and other factors. The point of Mr. Marchitelli's testimony was that this isn't suitable for the kind of development that we had in mind, that we had advanced so far. And we sought to impeach him with testimony that there had been exactly that. So that would be admissible as cross-examination for impeachment, even if the substantive document wouldn't be admissible in evidence. We didn't try to admit the previous listing into evidence. We sought to impeach him with it. Now, what the court did was it gave the jury part of the glass doctrine. It's been killing me not to say that the jury got a half-full glass. In this case, the jury should have received the full doctrine, the full glass, and the full set of instructions. Because it didn't, another jury should hear this case. Thank you for your interest in these issues.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.